أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم، بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم، اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم. Assalamu alaikum everybody and Eid Mubarak to all of you. I hope everybody had a blessed Ramadan inshallah, and we welcome you to episode 6 of the Poets of the Household. I know it's been a while, but sometimes life gets the best of you. You get busy with personal matters and then with the mosque, with Ramadan. So alhamdulillah, now that Ramadan is over, we are able to kind of take away, have some time, sorry, take some time away and be with you again on this episode 6, alhamdulillah, of the Poets of the Household podcast. I am your co-host, Abbas Jafri. I'm always with my brother, our other co-host, brother Naqi Rizvi, with us, with all of you here today. Naqi, how are you doing today?
Alhamdulillah, doing great and really excited about this one. There's a lot that we can discuss and unpack for today, so really excited to hear all this stuff. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. That's a great segue. So yes, today will be a very interesting conversation. Should be a good one. So let's get started. Alhamdulillah, we are joined here by Dr. Reza Mir, who is located in the New Jersey area. And he is, mashallah, a professor of management at the William Paterson University in New Jersey. As a management researcher, he focuses on issues relating to power, coercion, and resistance in organizational studies. He has co-edited or co-authored 5 books in that field. The latest book is titled Philosophy and Management Studies, A Research Overview, which was published by Routledge in 2022. And his research has been cited in over 3,000 papers, mashallah. In addition, he has an interest in literature and literary criticism and is a translator of works from Urdu into English. His 5 books in this area include a novel titled Murder at the Mushaira, which Shashi Tharoor referred to as the best historical novel I've ever read. He has also written on the traditions of progressive Urdu poetry and compiled literary biographies of Mirza Ghalib and Allama Muhammad Iqbal. Dr. Reza Mir, thank you so much for being with us here today. How are you today?
Thank you very much for that generous introduction, Abbas. I'm very fine. Thank you very much. And I look forward to chatting with you and Naqi today.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah. Again, thank you so much for being with us here today. So let's get started. So, you know, the first question that we had for you, Doctor, is, you know, based on your biography that I just read, we see that you are a professor of management, mashallah. So because, you know, being a professor of management and poetry are very two different fields. So what led you to your interest and love and your passion for poetry?
Yes, that is a wonderful question to begin. We are, after all, we always contain multitudes within ourselves, and I'm no different. And much of our personality is also shaped by certain experiences that we have. As growing up as a Shia in Hyderabad in India, I attended majalis quite regularly. And while I was never formally tutored in Urdu, Urdu is theoretically my mother tongue, but in Hyderabad we speak a certain what
dialect.
Can be called a dialect, it's the argot of its own, so much so that Hyderabadis are a little embarrassed to speak in front of non-Hyderabadis because they consider their language to be a little mixed, which need not. But the Azadari space was imbued with traditional Urdu. And as you know, the majalis of the subcontinent contain a lot of poetry. You begin with the Soz and Salam, which are often very traditional and very classical poems in their own right. When the speaker is speaking, they often quote Shairi quite a bit. And of course, Arabic, when the Quran is recited, is a marvelously poetic language. You had a session with the late Maulana Asad Jafri, who really brought that out beautifully. And then there are Nohas. So over a period of time, Urdu poetry entered my consciousness. And through that, you know, continued to study that, and then came to the United States to study management, and found out that there was an entire subculture of people engaging in literary criticism, which I then became a part of. And so that's how I went,
That's
actually,
amazing.
interesting, from religious poetry, from Risai Shairi, to you know, mainstream poetry.
That's phenomenal, because, like, you know, we all have our daily lives, our fields that we work in to earn a living, to feed our families. And then, you know, on the side, we have our love for poetry. Like, we listen to poetry, you know, some of us write poetry, but it's more of a, I guess, lack of a better term, like a hobby, right? It's something that we enjoy doing, that we love listening to. And because of our time, when it comes to, like, because of the time that we take of working and providing for our families, we don't have time to engage or indulge in a more of an academic field when it comes to Urdu or poetry in general. Like, we just listen to it, like I said, as a hobby. But mashallah, you were able to focus on your academic for your work, which mashallah is your PhD, and look at Urdu poetry from an academic field as well. It's not like you just read it, and because, like you said, what you just said, like, from our childhood, Urdu poetry and poetry in general, whether it's Arabic or Farsi, because we have that attachment to the Ahlul Bayt and Azadar, we fall in love with that poetry. And so we engage in those gatherings, those majalis, like you said, those jashans, things of that nature. But it stops right there. Mashallah, you were able to take it to another level, where it just didn't stop from you there. It didn't stop for you there. It went to another level from an academic perspective. So that's, mashallah, that's very, very good to hear, man. Mashallah, that's amazing.
And one thing I find interesting, and I know this is like your area of interest, and a lot of your publication is in this area as well, is like the development of Shia devotional poetry in the Urdu language. And why I find that interesting, especially someone who is very involved in the English poetry scene, is you know, Urdu is not too old comparatively, right? It's a couple hundred years, maybe 400 or 500 years old or so, and it probably faced a lot of the similar challenges maybe that English is facing today, when you know, those traditions came into the subcontinent. Could you shed some light? I know we don't, you know, of course this probably can be a whole session on its own, but maybe briefly shed some light on like a little bit of that historical context of how Shia devotional poetry was developed in the subcontinent in the Urdu language.
Yes. Yes. So it could be argued that the Urdu language has a longer history, about 600 years. But what you mentioned, Naqi, about the last 2 to 250 years is that the infusion of Persian in particular enriched Urdu substantially at that point in time. And it is in this field in particular that our Risai poets, the poets of, I would say the poets of martyrdom in particular, played a very significant role. As you know, right through the traditions of both Urdu and Farsi poetry, are beholden to qasidas in praise of Imam Ali and mournful elegies in the about the martyrdom of Imam Hussein in Karbala. And Urdu was no exception. So if you think of some of the great poets of Urdu, Mir Taqi Mir, Mirza Ghalib, Muhammad Iqbal, all of these, by the way, Mir identified as a Shia, but neither Ghalib nor Iqbal identified as Shia. But their devotion this household was quite legendary. And even poets like Faiz Ahmad Faiz tried their hand at the Marsiya tradition. And in the metaphor, in the canonical metaphor of Urdu poetry, issues of relating to Imam Ali and relating to Karbala kept coming in. And Kal Yazido Shimr the or Aaj Bante Ho Hussein, and things like that, to describe an oppressor, it just keeps coming in. I would say that particularly Ghalib, for example, considered himself a Banda of Ali, literally, you know, he went to that point where he thought of Ali as his spiritual godhead. And Ghalib's role in enriching the canon of Urdu poetry is legendary. I also want to particularly focus on 18th century and 19th century Lucknow. Lucknow, as you know, or the Kingdom of Awadh, as it was known, just not just the city of Lucknow, was a Shia, hotbed. And there we were blessed to have a series of poets who were of great importance. And in particular, the period between 1800 and 1860 saw these two stalwarts, right? Anis and Dabir, who everybody knows. Now, it was perhaps the greatest accident of history that two of the greatest poets of Urdu language, and I'm not talking about the Urdu, religious tradition, but actually two of arguably the greatest poets of the Urdu language not only lived together, but operated their craft together, and they were frenemies in a manner of speaking. And so they enriched each other through this competitive spirit. And for example, Dabir was known as a very florid poet. He layered his poems with so many similes and metaphors that they became the stuff that people deployed in other spheres as well. By contrast, Anis was more of a people's poet, so he tried to keep his language very simple, but he was a very visual poet, and he thought of Karbala's battles very intricately, and he described them in very homespun language. So between the two of them, they really enriched the vocabulary by, I would say, about 3 to 5 thousand words. This is what literary people say were brought into the language by these two poets themselves. And then, of course, Iqbal and others took them there. This is not very uncommon, by the way. Religious poetry, if you go back to Italian, for example, the Italians would say that Dante Alighieri, the poet who wrote the Divine Comedy and things like that, he was one of the people who gave life to the Italian language. So what we are saying is not that different. The Urdu language itself was given life to by a lot of poets, these two in particular. And then, of course, those metaphors then, suffused through the rest of the canon.
MashaAllah, that's a great historical perspective as to how, like for example, like exact like especially for those in our forefathers who migrated to North India, for example, from Iran and from from Medina, for example, and then they migrated to Iran and then they came to India, like because that's always been a question, right? How did Urdu poetry become so vast and so amazing, like because it's so deep and so rich, like it's an emotional language, it's a poetic language. So us to have an understanding, and that it's very key because that does lead me to my next question. Now, as you know, we are known as the poets of the household. So we're a group that's dedicated to English poetry on a religious platform. So for those of listeners who may not be of Urdu background, the term Rasai Adab is more focused towards religious poetry, which is what we focus on here. So, so you've mentioned just a plethora of legendary poets in our history, like you mentioned Mir Taqi Mir, Mirza Dabir, Mirza Ghalib, Allama Iqbal, and of course, as we would probably say the father of Urdu poetry when it comes to religious poetry in Urdu, Mir Anis, right? So since you have been studying into the life of Mir Anis, as we mentioned, who is a key foundational figure in the growth and building of Urdu literature, how do you think we can grow English poetry in the same way when it comes to the praise of the Ahlul Bayt living here in the West? Because, and the reason why I asked that question is because, in Urdu poetry, because you have your Rasai Adab, your religious poetry, and then you have your non-religious poetry. However, those who did the non-religious poetry, like Ghalib and maybe Iqbal and things of that, even like in this genre, like John Elia, for example, they did not focus on religious poetry, but they were still Muslims. They still adhere to the religion of Islam. However, here in the West, when you look at English poets like Shakespeare, William Blake, Edgar Allan Poe, for example, they're not Muslims, right? So we don't have that background like Urdu poetry did. So we're trying to create something here in the West. So based on your opinion, based on, on what you've seen, on what you've studied for Urdu poetry, how do you think we can kind of grow English poetry in the same way when it comes to the praise of the Ahlul Bayt living here in the West?
So I have been reading English poetry relating to the Ahlul Bayt and to religious matters for the past 20 years. And I would say that I'm very impressed by what we have already achieved as a community, what I would say your generation has achieved already. Now, slowly and very unself-consciously, English poets are coming into their own, particularly in terms of the crafting of a new Risai tradition. I could still use that word in English. The level of sophistication that some of our poets have shown in the spoken word field, we have a bright future. However, like you said, unlike, say, the progression from Arabic to Farsi to Urdu, which was relatively contiguous, perhaps there is a break that comes when people, particularly of South Asian and Arab origin, those who are born here but nonetheless who have that lineage, engage with their communities and share their poetry with them. Now, poetry at the end is craft, right? There's a lot of bad stuff that is floating out there. People just write prose and break it up into, sentence segments and think it's poetry. But that is not poetry. What are the parameters through which poetry is to be judged? What are the aesthetic standards that we are to follow? This is something to be collectively determined. And I think it is being determined. The most important thing to do here is to create those spaces where people can actually ply their craft. Right now, I think that the hegemony of particularly Urdu and even to that some extent Punjabi poetry in our Imam Bargahs is very strong. Slowly it will yield some space. It is very important for us to translate some of the metaphors because the metaphors are very rich and enriching and they connect to our background. So how we translate it into English language is a work in progress. But to the extent that I have heard young people practice their craft, I am very encouraged.
Inshallah, that's great.
I have a follow-up question on the question that was asked and the answer that you responded with as well. Today, when we look at Urdu poetry in general, especially devotional poetry, we see like this is such a great heritage that we receive, right? But I'm sure that in the initial stages of the Urdu language, was there any difficulty that you've found in your research doing this that they might have faced? For example, when we look at the Marsiya Khani of Mira Anis, like you mentioned, a lot of the language that's used, it seems like, Karbala was reimagined as it happened within the subcontinent.
Yes.
The relationships that they have with each other, the language they use, a lot of the concepts like Hijra and Visal, a lot of this it was reimagined within that context, right?
Yeah.
Was there any challenges at that time adopting this reimagination in the subcontinent in the subcontinent view? Because the reason I ask this is when we're trying to reimagine this in the Western context, looking at Karbala, in the similar way that they adopted in the subcontinent, there is a lot of friction there as well, right? So I'm interested in knowing a little bit of that background as well.
Oh, yeah. There was tremendous pushback. This pushback was overcome. I mean, once a battle is won, kind of the messiness of the battle is kind of forgotten.
Yeah.
But people did not like Urdu. Urdu, of course, was not a language of Muslims. When particularly at that point in time, a lot of Hindus were speaking Urdu, and people thought that translating, you know, the Quranic ideas and you know, spiritual ideas, and talking about Bibi Fatima, who is a very you know, divine-like figure, was somehow very contaminating. So fatwas were issued, people were boycotted, and all that happened. And but they sort of overcame that. And what you said, Naki, which was, you can imagine, quite controversial at that time, they just transported Karbala into a Awadhi spectacle, right down to the smell of the jasmine in the Sahara, and you know how somebody, you know, grieved for somebody, and you know the language was very, very localized. Now today, for example, you know, some of the ways in which people can will craft this is to talk about you know, things that are happening in today's world and frame it in Karbala terms. You know, what is happening in Gaza, or what is happening in certain parts of the world, if you compare it to Karbala, and if you use certain language of similes, there will be somebody who will be upset, and there will be somebody who will be upset enough that, you know, they'll make your life a little unpleasant. These are things to be gone through, and they went through all of that. They went through all of that. They struck compromises along the way. They bowed to patronage in a certain way. Some of them had their entire corpus struck from the record. It's not something that they could, you know, help. And all that happened. But it is in the nature of the poet to push the boundary. And I
right.
would be very supportive of them if they did that.
Right. Because you know, I think a very important point you brought up is, you know, the pushback and growing poetry and things of that nature. Because I mean, we're kind of facing something similar, I would say, here in the West, because we have an open field right now where we're trying to cultivate, and we're really trying to test our boundaries, I would say, because it's new, right? Just like when Urdu, when they migrated from Persian to Urdu, Miranese, as you mentioned, they were really, like you said, reimagining Karbala, bringing in new kind of concepts, not new, but in presenting it in a new way, I would say. Whatever was there in our history, in our books, just presenting in a very poetic way. And like you said, poets are there to push the boundaries. So, because Naki and I, and even in our circle, we have these conversations all the time, because we kind of struggle as well. Like, should we have structure in our poetry, behad, wazn, meter, weight, all that stuff? Or should we focus more on a spoken word? You know, like we have Nazm in Urdu, Azad Nazm, Nasreen Nazm, things of that nature as well. Should we focus that on English as well? Because at the end of the day, the goal is poetry. Whether you want to bound that within a meter or a weight, or if you want to have a free-flowing spoken word type poetry, that's something we're still trying to understand here. Because in Western literature, Western poetry, free form spoken word is very welcomed. Whereas in Urdu, it's kind of like, yes, you can do that once you understand the bounds and the behad and the wazn and the meter, then you can cultivate that. But here it's kind of different. So we're really trying to figure out things out here as well. But, you know, one of the things I wanted to ask you is, and you've already touched on this, you might have already answered this, but, you know, I think it's good to ask the question more directly in this way is, you know, here in the West, we're kind of having a generational battle, right? There seems to be a struggle between the generation that migrated here versus this generation that was born here in regards to language. So there seems to be those who say, you know, everything should be in Urdu. We should really hold on to the language. And some saying introducing English in our majalis and praise of the Ahlul Bayt should happen. Some say it shouldn't happen. Because the thing is we're so in love with our mother tongue, right? We're so in love with Urdu. And Urdu is a very rich, deep, beautiful language. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't be introducing new languages when it comes to the Ahlul Bayt. Because, like, I'm not an expert in Arabic. I'm not an expert, but I think I can confidently say that Arabic might be richer than Urdu, right? Arabic might be deeper than Urdu, but that doesn't mean that we should not have introduced Urdu, because if we were still staying between Arabic and Farsi, then these diamonds in the rough would not have come out like Anis, Ghalib, Iqbal, etc. So in your opinion, Doctor, you know, what's your stance on it? Like, should we hold on to that Urdu? Should we still hold on to the generation? Or should we introduce English and start growing this and so it can prosper into the new generations, just like it did with Urdu in India?
Thank you. That lovely question. It has two parts, so I also want to address the first part. As far as rhyme and meter are concerned, I would say that it would be a mistake to imprison yourself, because those are protocols that belong to another language. Mm. And within that language, a certain entire lexicon of rhyme and meter has come. Believe me, it's much easier to write a ghazal in English, in Urdu, than it is in English. And no ghazal written in English will sound as good because those protocols are not there. So as far insofar as you guys are actually now seniors and you are nurturing younger poets, don't imprison them with those protocols at all. Let it flow any which way. So that's my first point. As far as the second point about languages is concerned, you see, Urdu as a language, its demise and the fact that it is in danger has been talked about for over a century. It is neither in demise nor is it in danger. There are enough adherents and, you know, enough of us who follow it. You are here trying to build a multicultural society, a multicultural society that is making its tentative forays into a tradition that may last for centuries. So to kind of get stuck there would be, I mean, it's really, I would imagine, in my mind at least, it is a settled debate. It's not about whether you want to do it in English or not, but how to do it well and how to do it best. You have to move in that direction. And, you know, I would say that we've already reached escape velocity. Alhamdulillah, there's a lot of good speakers. What we really lack right now, I think that we really need to imbue our language, both our prose and our poetry, with affect. When you reach the Masayib in Urdu, people just weep inconsolably.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a matter of a decade, two decades before people develop that ability in Urdu. We are at a transition moment. There's no need to feel particularly, you know, there's no angst about why don't people cry when Masayib are in English. It'll come.
I have a follow-up question on this as well. And more particularly in your experience in translating Urdu poetry in general as well. You know, I think there's two very good things. One is just writing poetry from scratch without any of that, you know, baggage that we have in our mind, the heritage that we're carrying. I think a lot of that, we're starting to do a lot of it now, and it sounds a lot more natural to the English language, and people are doing it really well. But there's also a space for translations. And I think sometimes it's very beautiful when you bring in an idea or poetry from a different language into English and introduce that idea, that beautiful, the metaphors, or even just the concepts, ideas into English. And that's a whole genre on its own. I wanted to get your thoughts from your experience in translating. What are some of the challenges that you faced when you were translating Urdu to English, right? And what was your process like when you're doing that?
So translation is, of course, like you said, an act of migration. And a lot of people focus on what can be lost in translation. But you know, one can cling on to the hope that something is gained as well. It is really very important to ask yourself two very simple questions. One is that, is the meaning of what you are translated moved and migrated reasonably well into the other language? That is relatively easy. It can be done lexically. The second more important question is, what you have translated, does it communicate a sense of poetry? I find myself a little challenged on that account. My strength is that I'm mobile between the two languages. My weakness is that I'm not a poet. So I balance those two things. I do my best. But other people, there could be other people who have the exact opposite complementary strengths, that they are poets in their own right. And so they struggle lexically to understand the poem here. But I have read better translations than mine. Aga Shahid Ali, a man who I used to know well, he is no more, one of the great poets, and also, Shia in his own right. He did an excellent job of translating some of those poems and the ideas of Karbala. And then, you young people are doing such an excellent job. So,
one thing I find interesting is like sometimes in the process of translation, you're actually creating a brand new poem on its own, because like you mentioned, the second part, right. One is like lexically word by word, but in the process of trying to translate a meaning, we often find brand new metaphors, brand new language that's introduced, right? And I think it's something that I know people will sometimes refrain from doing, but sometimes it could produce very good pieces that are on their own right, besides being a translation of something, something very beautiful, and introduce something in the English language that wasn't already there. So, yeah.
It is a challenge.
It's almost like transforming it into, literally into other forms. Anis used to describe his poetry as painting. He said, I'm a painter. I'm painting images. And that is what good poets do. Yeah.
Yeah, it's great, because the thing is, and it's very fulfilling. Like when you translate something from one language to another, and then you kind of you have a, I would say, aha moment. Where like, okay, this hits the heart. It's like, okay, this word looks like this is good. Like, I mean, it's hard to kind of fully conceptualize that word sometimes, but we do have aha moments, I would say, when we translate things, and it feels good, because the thing is that this is a journey, right? The English now we're on a journey right now. We haven't reached, like, for example, like where Ghalib and Anis are, where people are saying, they'll write a ghazal or a manqabat or some sort of poetry in their honor or the zameen that they use. We're not there yet. We're getting there. And the journey is, half of the fun, because at the end of the day, it is worship. We're doing ibadat here. It's worship. And, the way us finding new ways of doing worship is always great. And it's great that we're part of this journey and that we have seniors like yourself, doctor, and our elders who are very supportive. And I find that, very encouraging, because we discuss this all the time. Like I said, Naqi, and I think I speak for him, is that, we're kind of hesitant to get in the English space because we're born in Urdu, we've raised in Urdu. And so it's like, are we doing some sort of disservice by pushing a new language and introducing a new language? But then when we see elders and seniors like yourselves and other poets who are really encouraging us to do it, it really, like, it feels good, alhamdulillah, and we're very blessed to have individuals like yourself and other poets who are really pushing us towards this, especially you. Like, the work, like I said, like we do it as a hobby, we do it as something that we enjoy and love, but you were to take your worldly academic and bring in your religious academic and put it together and really present something very beautiful. So it's very commendable that what you've done is very, very nice.
Thank you very much. And I would say that, again, since the two of you are playing the role of mentors to younger people, it is very important to bring this Urdu poetry into the Imam Bargahs. Carve out some spaces, because the crowd that is there, their love for the Ahle Bayt is such that it will transcend the sort of difficulty they have in understanding newer, literary forms. And I think that is very important. It's it's great to have gatherings of young people somewhere else. We have Muharram in Manhattan at NYU here or something like that. That's all great, but we got to suck it into the Imam Bargahs. We've got to recite poetry under alums. Tabuts are taken out, and only that way it will be mainstreamed.
Mashallah.
Inshallah, we all pray that we can reach that time one day where we can have this as part of our culture, part of the regular programming. And we at the Poets of the Household, we're trying our best to try to incorporate this, even at least locally for now, and then inshallah in the future, more globally in the North America and the UK. But I wanted to thank you, Arez Uncle, for all the time that you were able to give us, the insights that you were able to provide, and speaking from your experience, your research. We have this tradition where we do like to end our program with some poetry. And forgive me if I'm putting you on the spot here, but if you have any of your favorite lines of poetry that that you know you find yourself coming back to, or any poem that you maybe poetry that you've written or translated that you are particularly very fond of, we'd love to hear that.
And in any language too, English, Urdu, whatever you
yeah,
think.
I would like, again, like I told you, poetry is craft. And I want to recite 6 lines by Mir Anis. Just offer a little translation also, in which he talks about craft. And he is sort of praising himself. I will recite all the 6 lines quickly, and then I'll just offer a quick, very quick translation.
Sure, Bismillah.
He says, khalame fikr se khenchu jo kisi bazm ka rang, shamme tasveer pe girne lage aa ke patang, aur saaf hairat zada mani ho to behzad ho dang, aur khoon barasta nazar aaye jo dikhaun safe jang, razm aisi ho کہ دل سب کے بھڑک جائیں ابھی بجلیاں تیغوں کی آنکھوں میں چمک جائیں ابھی.
Wow.
What he is saying is that with the pen of my khalame fikr, with the pen of my thought, if I paint a mehfil, a bazm, کہ کھینچو کسی بزم کا رنگ, I will create the picture of a shama, and on that the moths are going to, I mean, it'll be so clear that the moths are going to go and, you know, fall on it.
Wow.
And Mani and Behzad were two great painters of the Persian era. So, Saaf Hairat Zada Mani Ho To Behzad Ho Dang. You see how he is transporting between art forms. And then this is very important. Karbala was a battle. Karbala was a battle. And, you know, in the battle, you have to describe it. خون برستا نظر آئے جو دکھاؤں صفے جنگ, and رزم is again the battle, رزم ایسی ہو کہ دل سب کے بھڑک جائیں ابھی. You remember that line of you know, دبیر سے کس شیر کی آمد ہے کہ رن کام
رہا
ہے. That one line itself gives you this goosebumps saying, oh, حضرت عباس is coming, کس شیر کی آمد ہے کہ رن کام رہا ہے. So he's also saying the same thing, ke razm aisi ho ke dil sab ke bhadak jaye kabhi, and I will show the swords moving as if, you know, lightning is falling. So this is a standard of craft for all of us to aspire to and bring into English. Thank you.
MashaAllah. I don't think we could find a better way to end off today's podcast, today's episode. You could see the beauty, literally. Poets don't write words with their pen. They literally are drawing pictures with their words. And we can see that with the verse, the bund that you presented today, Reza Uncle. So I think, again, like, there's no better way we can end off today's episode. On behalf of the Poets of the Household, we'd like to thank you for your time today. I think a lot of us have learned a lot today with the history and how we should amalgamate that and transition that and use history as a way to learn to present and bring forth English poetry into the West, inshallah, when it comes especially to the praise of the Ahlul Bayt, inshallah. So on behalf of all of us, Reza Uncle, we just want to thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. It has been an honor and a pleasure. Good night.
JazakAllah. Again, thank you everyone for your time today. This has been another episode of the Poets of the Household. Thank you so much for your time, and inshallah, we'll see you again for the next episode. JazakAllah. Khuda Hafiz.